We are going to do a very short introduction because of our lack of time to cover this book. And we're going to try and cover seven chapters tonight. Set land speed record. Okay, we're going to see if we can do this. As far as talking about Samuel, what do we know about Samuel? Authorship-wise, who are we talking about here? Does this book that you know of, does this book say, hey, I wrote this? It doesn't. It's one of those anonymous letters. But we know, and later on, as is mentioned here, 1 Chronicles talks about that Samuel, Nathan, and Gad were the ones that wrote about the life of David. And so, at least up until chapter 25, Samuel could have been the author. What happened at 25 that kind of permits or does not allow Samuel to be the author? He dies. It's hard to write a book when you're dead, right? I mean, I don't know about you. I haven't done it lately. But it's hard to continue writing a book when you're dead. So it's probably, that's why it's a compositive situation as far as the authorship. Date range, we're talking about 1100 BC to about 90 or to about 110 BC, which it's like those numbers that we can't really comprehend. Who counts backwards? We don't do this. Just date-wise, we're covering about 90 years in the early history and a change. As you look at 1 Samuel, what are some things you think of? What are some stories you remember from 1 Samuel? Just information. Anything you remember from 1 Samuel? An unknown book. Hannah has a child. Anything else, 1 Samuel? What's that? Eli's in there, yes. What about King David? Do you think he pops up in this book? Yes, he's a prominent figure. What's the book previous to 1 Samuel? Ruth and Judges, right? This is an open book. Y'all can open it up. So Ruth and Judges are previous to what's going on timeline. Y'all just finished these books, right? Studying that in here. What's going on timeline wise? You have the period of the Judges, right? And that cycle that repeats. We are going to move into a new system in the book of Samuel. So Samuel is a book. Main theme is transition. We're transitioning into something different. Moving into something different. So from Eli to Samuel, just character-wise, Eli to Samuel, Samuel to Saul, Saul to David, and then also, you know, judges to a judge prophet, which Samuel's a little bit different, and then moving over into kings kind of ruling the land. So there's a lot of transition in this book. How many of you watch movies? Anybody in here? Anybody admit they watch movies? Okay. All right. So anyway, so we watch movies, and as you go through a movie, and you've seen this, there's like 100 of these type of movies, right, where you have the old regime and the way you do things, right? And then a new guy comes in, the chosen one, and this chosen one ushers in change and ushers in a new era, right? And then after the chosen one gets older, then this new regime change comes in, right? Have you seen a movie like that? There's 100 of them out there, right? 100 of them. And so they got that from the Bible, probably. You know, that this Samuel talks about that very kind of, that's that change. And we're going to see that very early on. And we're going to try and, like I said, cover the first seven chapters. But some things we also need to look at. The Philistines, you've heard about those guys? They're quite a prominent villain in the Bible, right? Prominent villain in the Bible. The Philistines, as far as where they came from, they're not just, you know, the Bible decides, well, we're writing a bad guy. Let's write in Philistines. They were an actual people. They came probably from Crete and from that area. They were a seafaring people. They were called the Sea People in Exodus 23:31, as the Mediterranean Sea was called the Sea of the Philistines. They were also had five city-states. Any of you study ancient Greek? Nobody? Classical Greek? Anybody? Troy, Athens, those cities, the city-state concept. So they had that going on for them as far as ruling. They were also iron workers. They smelted iron, which is kind of cool in the process. But as far as if you're trying to be as tactical as possible in that time on that time frame, iron was the thing. All right, iron was like the Molly gear. Iron was like the polymer handguns and that kind of stuff of its day.
Weaponry.
Yes, because so the Jews came out of Egypt. Ancient swords. Anybody familiar with those? Maybe not. So Egypt, Bronze Age. Okay, they did bronze. The Philistines had iron. If you were going to have a sword and you got to choose between iron and bronze, which one would you choose?
I guess iron.
Probably iron, because in some cases the iron could kind of wreck your bronze sword a little bit and your shield and that kind of stuff. So they were a little more advantage. They had advantage of the sea and advantage of as far as armament is concerned. And so the Philistines were some bad dudes. Here is the head carving of actually a Philistine warrior. Can y'all see that from back there? Maybe next time we'll move forward. Does that sound like a good idea? Because there'll be pictures. So this is a carving from Egypt. So the Philistines came in first to Egypt and tried to settle there and conquer in that area. The Egyptians expelled them and they went up the coast and they settled in the cities in the plains along the sea. And the Philistines kind of took over that area. Some of these names you might recognize. Have you heard of Gaza? Anybody? Still same Gaza. Same Gaza. So that whole Gaza Strip. Is that a peaceful place?
No.
They're still having issues. Anyway, at least they're historically consistent. So anyway, so here, this is something that you'll, as far as the cities of the plains and the Philistines, we'll be talking a lot about that in these first few chapters, and those are the areas. And you'll see, I don't know which button makes the, yes, found it. Okay, can y'all see that? The button. Okay, so here is what we're talking about. Gaza's right here. This is like Saul's kingdom, and then adding in this color is where David kind of conquered and added in some more. And this is Philistia there, what they're left with after David gets done with them. And we're going to talk a lot about that. David even spends some time with his enemy when he's running from Saul. So they'll come up in our discussion. So we need to know about those people. All right. As we go through a book, it's important to have an outline. And this is a very simple outline of 1 Samuel. You have Samuel's judgeship, chapters 1 through 7, and then basically Saul's reign, 8 through 31, and intermixed in there is David in his story as he comes up and is anointed. And so we'll be obviously going into much more detail than what you see here, but this breaks the book down for us and helps us piece out the information. So as we start the study this morning or this evening, we're going to talk about Hannah. We're going to start talking about Hannah. So open your Bibles, chapter 1, or turn on your cell phone and open up your electronic device to chapter 1. And as we look here, we have a guy named Elkanah. Elkanah has and his wives, and we have two wives. If you look down in verse 4, when the day came when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly and to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. What are we talking about here? Here's a man who has two wives. Man who has two wives. There are some things that are better when there's more of them, right? I would not have more than one wife. One is perfect. I mean, think about it. How many? If you get into the day-to-day life of people who have more than one wife in the Old Testament, how many of them have drama? Abraham? Okay, I'm not going to go any farther with that. But you see what I'm saying here. Here he has Hannah. Hannah's womb is closed. And as we go through this chapter, they go up. They go up to Shiloh. Now, why are they going to Shiloh? Where do we normally go And when we talk about Jerusalem and the temple and that kind of stuff, where do we normally think? Jerusalem, right? We go up to Jerusalem. But they're going to Shiloh. Not the battlefield. They're going to Shiloh, right? That's where the tent is. This is way before a temple is built, before any of that kind of happens. And so they go to Shiloh, and that's where they go. And so Hannah rose, verse 9, after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat on the doorpost. And so Eli is there. And then what happens as you are looking at this chapter? Give me the story. What goes on in this first chapter? Hannah comes to Shiloh. And what does Hannah begin to do? To pray. She prays for a child. What's going on in Hannah's heart? She wants a child. She's being tortured by this other woman. She wants to have a child. And so she prays that, if you remember me, I look this verbiage here. She says, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and do not forget your maidservant. And so she asks for this. And asks that basically says, if you give me a child, I'll devote this child to you. Now, Eli, who is the high priest at the time, is sitting there, and he's watching this go down, and he sees her lips moving, but doesn't see the words coming out. And he thinks she's what? Drunk. This woman's drunk. And so she's like, no, I'm not drunk. I'm praying. And, you know, almost, I kind of get this idea, like, Eli's like, man, whatever. Whatever you prayed, I hope that happens. Get out of here, you crazy lady. We don't get that, but we see this sort of Eli already making this assumption about who Hannah is. But Hannah's very devout. And Eli says, may the Lord bless you. And she goes in peace. And of course, she bears a child. And the Lord remembered her in verse 19. And she bore a son. And then in verse 21, as we make this next change, Samuel is born. And they go up to Shiloh. Now, the practice is to go up to Shiloh every year, and she decides, well, I'll wait until he's weaned, and we'll go up, and we'll leave Samuel there, and he'll be devoted to the keeping and devoted to the work of the Lord there. So they go up, finally, when he's weaned, at the end of this chapter, and she says in verse 27, for this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me a petition, giving me my petition, which I asked. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord as long as he lives, and he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. And then we have chapter 2 begins this song or the prayer of Hannah. And I want to focus in on a section of this. So Hannah receives what she always wanted, and she leaves her son with Eli for the year. And later on, we're told that they come back every year, and she brings him his garments, a new garment every year when she comes back. But what she prayed for most earnestly, God granted that to her. And then we see this prayer of joy and exaltation of the Lord, knowing that God will take care of his people. And I want to focus on verse 3. It says, boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. Who was pestering her? There was an arrogant person who was pestering her, right? And so maybe she's preaching during this prayer. But she says, the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. Now this is very prominent or very, very poignant thought here. God is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. Is there any secret thing you can hide from God? No, there's not. And this is going to come around in the life of Eli. This is going to come. This very phrase is going to come around and be poignant in the life of Eli and his sons. So she prays this prayer, and then they go home. And in verse 11, the boy ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. And then beginning of verse 12, we have another section, the sons of Eli. We have Eli's rejection and Samuel's call, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 2. What's the first commentary we have of Eli's sons? They were corrupt. Is there any other words that are used there? What other words? Worthless. Now, I don't know about you. If you have children and somebody comes up to you and tells you about your kids, That kind of warms your heart, right? But if somebody comes up to you and says your children are worthless, is that something that you want to hear? Probably not. And the Bible here makes that commentary about Eli's sons. Your sons are worthless. If you want to write out there 2 Corinthians 6:15, does light have in common with Belial? It's the same word that's used here. It's just unrighteousness, ungodliness. This word involves all of that. And so Eli's sons were worthless. And the commentary we have here is they're priests, but they're not doing the priestly duty like they're supposed to. They're taking what they want from the sacrifices. And rather than waiting until it's actually burnt, they're just taking what they want before the sacrifice is even offered before God. And so they're literally robbing from God. And so they said, if you don't give it, so people say, well, I'm not going to give it to you that way. That's not the way you're supposed to do it. And they're getting in their face saying, you know, you better give me this or I'll make you give it to me. Sort of like the Sheriff of Nottingham kind of situation going on here as far as relationship, just taking from what they want from the people as they come to bring an offering. In verse 18, we have this change. So here we have this commentary of the sons and what's going on with them. And now Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy, and he was wearing a linen ephod, and his mother would make him a little robe and bring it to him year to year. So we have this kind of what's going on. And the continuing story of Hannah is that she continued to have. She ended up having 3 sons and 2 daughters. And so she was blessed. And she continued to have those children. And then as we look, Eli begins to rebuke his sons, which is common. Dads do that, right? They're supposed to do that. And so he recognizes what's going on. Would somebody read for us 22 through 25? Anybody? His rebuke. Anybody want to read that for us out loud?
Desire to kill them.
All right. So here Eli confronts them about what's going on, and what's the response? How do his children respond to this confrontation? They pretty much ignore him. I believe the vernacular these days, whatevs, I think is what kids say to parents these days. So they pretty much do that to Eli. But what does he say here? It's really, if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? Who is the intercessor? Not then. Not yet. Yeah, well, the priests, they were it though, but I mean, look how horrible they were acting, and you know, and what they were doing with women in front of the tabernacle actually kind of represents how they were influenced probably with Canaanite worship, and the Ashtaroth and those kind of things. So they were not pure by any stretch of the imagination. If you want to write out beside there Hebrews 7:25, talking about Christ who is ever ready to make intercession for us. That is what we have. That's the blessing that we have in Christ. They didn't have that, but we have that very thing. And so this is Eli and his sons. And it's seemingly that Samuel isn't really influenced by his sons. It appears that he's able to be kind of hedged away from the kind of influence about the sons. But look at verse 26. Now the boy Samuel was growing in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men. Does that sound familiar? Have you heard that somewhere? Jesus, right out there, Luke 2:52. You hear this about Jesus as well. And so this growing and maturation of Samuel, as he is going to be a big player in the religious concept and in the leadership of this nation. And so now in verse 27, a man of God comes to Eli. Now, a lot of times when a man of God comes, in some instances, it turns out to be an angel, Judges 13:6. And then in some instances, it's a man of God, a physical man of God. And actually, in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 10, Samuel was called a man of God. And then there's others. There's the man of God from Judah, 1 Kings 13:1. So there were. This is more than likely, probably a physical person. Although we're not given a name. So the man of God came to Eli and said, "Thus says the Lord: Did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your fathers when they're in Egypt and in bondage. Did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel, my priests, to go up to my altar and to burn incense and carry an ephod before me? Did I not give to the house of your father all the fire offerings and sons of Israel? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me, making yourselves fat? What is he saying here when he says, you're kicking at my offerings? We looked earlier at what his sons were doing, and they were taking what they wanted. They weren't actually making the physical offering like they were supposed to. And God says, you're disregarding my offering. You're disregarding my authority. And what does he say to Eli? You honor your sons above me. You honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choices of every offering of my people, Israel. And so then he goes on to tell them that he's going to take this away from them. Those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me, I will lightly esteem. And he says in verse 31, behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and your strength of your father's house, and you will see the distress of the dwellings in spite of all the good that I do for Israel. And if you keep going on down, verse 34, and this will be the sign that you will to you, which you will come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day, both of them will die, but I will raise up up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul. And I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before me, my anointed. And so he says, your sons are going to die. The sign that this is going to take place, that I'm taking this away from you, your sons will die. So we have this regime change, right? And we're going to see what happens with that. But he says here, but I will raise up for myself a faithful priest. Right out beside that, Hebrews 2, verse 17, if you want to make a note there. Hebrews 2, 17, in relationship to Christ, a faithful priest who's faithful in all things. These men were not faithful. They were not faithful in doing what God would have. They were in following God in the way he was supposed to, and obeying the commandments as far as a sacrifice, and just the general respect for God. They were not faithful by any stretch of the imagination.
They just took advantage of the situation.
Exactly. That's exactly what they did. They took what they wanted. Exactly. They were serving themselves rather than serving God. And so this is what happens. Look in... look in verse 36, everyone who is left in your house will come and bow down to him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and say, please assign me to one of the priest's offices that I may eat a piece of bread. Now contrast that with chapter 2, verse 29, when they were making themselves fat on the sacrifices. And so they're basically, God's going to flip the situation on them. So they were making themselves fat on the sacrifices of God. And he said, what's going to happen is that all those who are of your household, your descendants, will be coming to this priest and asking to be one of the priests so they can at least eat. And so he's flipping the scenario on them in this situation. And so this is the rebuke that Eli receives. And then Samuel is called by God. Well, have you heard this story before? Chapter 3, verses 1 through 21, basically this chapter. And it's interesting where this takes place. So this first piece of information in verse 1, he says, now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. Why would they give us that information before this story unfolds? Samuel ends up having a vision, or at least talking with God in this chapter. But the writer says, hey, this didn't happen a lot. This wasn't like, you know, every other day God was calling on a cell phone. This is not what was happening during this time, okay? So this was not common as this story is unfolds. And so they're lying down in his place, and is it with eyesight of Eli. And they're seemingly in the tabernacle when they're doing this. And what happens? What begins to happen? Samuel hears somebody calling him, right? And Samuel's response is what? Here I am. He goes over to Eli, right? And Eli's like, I didn't call you. Go back to bed. Then it happens a second time, right? And he goes to Eli, and Eli's like, boy, I didn't call you. I say, boy. And so he didn't call him, right? The third time, light bulb goes on, right? We're slow sometimes. Light bulb goes on, and what does Eli say? Verse 9. Speak, I think you said it, Freddie. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening, right? And that's the response. What kind of response is that to God? What does that say about you and your relationship with God? If that's your response to God, what does that say about you?
You're receptive.
You're receptive? Yes, yes. God was communicating with Samuel. What else? Yes. You were in subjection to, and we're going to see that, hopefully we'll see that if we get to that point in the study tonight, that there's a difference between those who are subject to God and those who are not. So a person who's subject to God, and this is, hears the voice of God, and we do that when we read the Bible. Have you ever thought about that? I'm reading the Bible, and these are the words that God wanted us to know. Hear my, your servant, listen. So here is, speak, Lord, your servant, listen. So here's your servant listening. In this case, and the Lord came and stood and called as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel said, speak, your servant listening. And the Lord said to Samuel, behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day, I will carry out against Eli all that I've spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. And we read that already. He said, I have told him that I'm about to judge his house forever and iniquity which he knew. Look what he says here, because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he did not rebuke them. What are we learning about Eli and his practice with his children? Maybe not have best practices in relationship to, and is it possible to get so focused on other things that we forget to focus on the very most important thing that's right under our feet that we're supposed to be paying attention to? That happens, right? We're looking out, we're going through the things we're supposed to be doing. He's the high priest. He's probably got a few responsibilities, right? But what responsibilities did it seem like he neglected? His children. The raising of his children. Raising and disciplining his children. Now, discipline's not a word we want to use a lot. You know, and discipline's changed. You know, nobody ever took a cell phone away from me to discipline me. Discipline's changing, okay? I'm not, so those things, that was never a punishment for me. That was not an option. Received the Board of Education several times, but as far as a cell phone, that was not something that was an option. But he didn't do that, and it was a detriment not only to his children, but to himself. This was a generational, and you see that in as far as that generational cycle and things that repeat in families. Psychologically, you see that in families, habits that repeat, things that repeat. Somebody at some point has to break that cycle. And it took God stepping in to break the cycle here with Eli. So Samuel lays down, and then, you know, Eli knows that God spoke to Samuel. Eli's already had this information of doom from God already. So he's probably just a wee bit curious as to what God said to Samuel, right? And we, as you read the text, Eli called to Samuel and said, Samuel, my son, and he said, here I am. And he said, what is it the Lord spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also if you hide anything from... That's pretty serious. Whoa, slow down, Eli. It's too early, man. Why are you... And getting all up in me about this, just okay. So he gets up in his face about the information, and before Samuel even has a chance to respond about what God has said, Eli's issuing curses to Samuel to make sure he says everything, and he tells him everything. I don't suspect that Samuel would have held anything back, but he made sure that he did that. Verse 19, Samuel continues to grow, which is good. Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him. and let none of his words fail. All of Israel from Dan even to Beersheba. So when we talk about Dan to Beersheba, what are we we're talking about all of Israel. I was trying to remember the song. From the plains of something, something, to the hills of Tennessee. It's that kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about? It's that kind of, we're talking about all of Israel. I can't remember the song. You're laughing at me now. But anyway, that's the concept that we're talking about. When we talk about Dan to Beersheba, everybody knew what? Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And we had already said earlier that this isn't normal. Like, this isn't happening. So here comes Samuel, this prophet. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, and because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. So this continues to happen. And this, as far as we know, this is the first time that there's a prophet's been confirmed since Moses. Yes, ma'am.
Where was Beersheba?
Beersheba's in the south. Dan's in the north, and Beersheba's in the south. If you have like your Bible maps in the back, it might reference that. I'm sure you can probably Google it, right? I'll show you mine afterward. So this is, again, a big deal as far as the confirmation of Samuel and the transition. I don't have a watch on. How much time do I got? Oh, man. How much time do I have?
8 more minutes.
Okay. We're not going to make it, guys. So, chapter 4, Philistines happen, okay? In a nutshell, the Philistines happen. Now, the Philistines have been pestering them, and so the word of Samuel, this begins to be confirmed here in the situation. Many were killed in a battle against the Philistines, and so they decide, well, let's go get the ark. Let's go get the ark, and we'll bring the ark out, and surely we'll win. They go out and they say, this is my boomstick, right? They're coming out, and they're going to win because they have the ark of the Lord, right? The ark of the Lord. They're surely going to win. So they have the Ark of the Lord. And so they go out. And as the Ark comes in to the camp, everybody starts screaming and shouting and hooping and hollering, and they're going to win. Now, if you hear your enemy camp going crazy on the other side of the valley, what are you going to think? We might want to pay attention. It says here the Philistines were afraid. It was like, uh-oh, God has come into the camp. Now, they're not ignorant about the things that God has done. They begin saying, hey, this is a God that destroyed the Egyptians. Listen to what they said. These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all the kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage. So they begin to try to have to build themselves up because they know what God has done. Cliff Notes version, it didn't go so well for the Israelites. The ark was captured. The Philistines routed them. And so a messenger comes running back. His clothes are ripped. He's already done the ash on his head. And he's running back to Shiloh to tell them what happens. He tells everybody, everybody's screaming and wailing as he's coming in. He goes to Eli. He tells Eli, Eli, your sons are dead. And the ark is taken. And when he hears the ark is taken, he falls backwards off his seat and dies, breaks his neck. He says, the text says he was a rather large man. Also, what this text doesn't tell us, but probably we can kind of assume from Jeremiah 7:12 and also 1 Samuel 21:1, it's possible that Shiloh was also destroyed shortly after this. And so that whole system is gone. When Shiloh, the Ark of the Covenant never comes back to Shiloh. And Shiloh's never again a center of religious thought for the Israelites. So we'll start with chapter 5 next time. But chapter 5 begins. Maybe we can get it. We have 5 minutes? Yes, okay. We can get chapter 5 probably. So chapter 5, the Philistines take the ark, and it doesn't go good for them. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, anybody seen that? Okay, so that happens. They got it again from the Bible. So all good movies come from the Bible. So the Philistines took the ark of the God, and they brought it, and they put it next to their god, Dagon, and it falls down, and they stand it back up, and it falls down again, and the head falls off, and the arms come off, and then they begin to have tumors in verse 6. Does anybody else have a different word other than tumors in verse 6 of chapter 5? Tumors? Yes. So it is something to. So the text, it's either hemorrhoids or some hemorrhaging, blood hemorrhaging situation. So they were also later on. We see that they were pestered with rats or mice as well. So some have said, well, maybe it's a bubonic plague because the rats were involved, and there's some hemorrhaging involved with that. Others said, well, it's hemorrhoids. Others just leave it as tumor. But we knew anyway. No, we're not gonna. That would be horrible. So, in verse 21 of chapter 5, it says, "The men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven." So it was so bad they were crying out loud because of these tumors that they had. What they were exactly, the text says they were hemorrhaging of some sort, and so. Chapter 6 begins this process of returning the ark. So you have something that is making you sick. And it took them a while for them to realize that, hey, maybe it's the ark. Maybe it's the ark. And so then they begin to do this hot potato thing in chapter 5 where they send it to another city. And they're like, no, don't send it to us. We don't want the... So here's what's going on that side of the camp of the Philistines. They called for the priests and diviners, what shall we do in chapter 6? And they decide to send it back. So they make an ark, they make a cart, a new cart, and they have two oxen that have never pulled a cart. And they actually make golden sculptures, 5 golden sculptures of their tumors and 5 golden sculptures of the rats. And they send that as an offering with this. Depending on what kind of tumor that was, that would have been an interesting sculpture. So they send that on, and it goes up to what? To Beth Shemesh, right? It goes up and goes there. Now, Beth Shemesh was a Levitical city. It was a Levitical city. So it's and the kings kind of followed behind the cart at a distance. What kind of saddles they're riding? Don't know. So they were following this cart to make sure it left, right? To make sure it left. And it left. And the people of Beth Shemesh were glad to have it. They made an offering of the cattle that they received. But they did something that they weren't supposed to do. If you look in chapter 6, verse 19, he struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. And so how many died? 50,070 died. Because they looked into the ark of the Lord. Readers of the Lost Ark might give us a clue as to how they died. I don't know. But they died, right? They weren't supposed to look into this. So they got, Hollywood got it from the Bible. They should have known that. They got curious. Maybe, and honestly, maybe they're thinking, well, hey, do we still have the Ten Commandments? Do we still have Aaron's rod? Do we still have everything that's supposed to be in there? And maybe they innocently, hey, we got to check that out, right? We got to check this out. But they weren't supposed to do that. And so anyway, that's what happens in chapter 6. And so eventually they send it off to another city in chapter 7, Kiriath-Jearim, and it stays there for about 60 years until David builds and moves it later on. Oh, we got just into chapter 7. So we'll finish chapter 7 next week. And if you want to read ahead a little bit and get familiar with Samuel as we make it through, we'll be going pretty fast through this as we only have about 6 classes together to get through 31 chapters. So thank you for your time this evening.